Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, July 18th, 2010, and this is show number 269. Well, I tell you what, how about I drone on and on endlessly about the iPhone 4 antenna issue today? What? You're sick of the subject? Yeah, me too. Jeez, is there anything else to talk about? Well, today we have a spectacular show that is completely antenna discussion free. You know why we have a great show? Because the NoSilla Castaways are the best. I put the call out to you guys to help me out this week by making some recordings so I could relax and play at Disneyland with my family for a few days, and you came through like champs. We have some recordings from the usual beloved suspects, and even some from people who have never made recordings before. And guess what? They're all fantastic. There is not a dud amongst them, no matter what Mark Fawcett says. I think you're going to love this show and maybe even hope I leave more often. Now that I think about it, I'm going to need a little help when I go to Europe, too, so start thinking of what you want to record. Anyway, thank you all for letting me have a great worry-free vacation. It was fantastic to just play. I have a big announcement to make. The youngest NoSilla castaway is being born right during this recording, or soon after. We heard from Matt, also known as Balding Nerd, right before the show, and he gave the best excuse ever for not going into the live show. He and his wife are having a baby tonight. So big shout out to both of them, their son, and their new child. I'd also like to give a shout out to our good friend Pat Mon. Not sure what's going on, but we're all thinking about you here, Pat. Before we get into the meat of things, though, let me give you an update on our European vacation tour. Don McAllister set up a webpage where you can register your interest in a Liverpool tweet-up over at themaxscreencastguy.com. I put a direct link to where you can register over in the show notes. The plan is going to be for Tuesday, August 24th, and all you have to do is go to that site, enter your name and email address, and as Don firms up the details, you'll get notified. This is also going to help him figure out how many people are interested in coming so he can pick an appropriate venue. Maybe it's a table for four outside, or three, just the three of us. Anyway, Nightwise says he's picked the perfect venue for the Belgian tweet-up. He's going to do it as a Facebook invite to start with, but I can't remember what day we said we'd do it, so I'll have to give you an update on that one. The Irish tweet-up will be on Saturday night, the 28th of August, but I'm not sure how that plan's going to come together on that one either, so stay tuned. Well, let's get started in the show with a review from good friend of the show, Donald Burr of Otaku No Podcast.
Hey there, Allison. Donald from Otaku No Podcast here with another of my famous reviews. This time I'm reviewing the Hyperdrive, Photo Viewer, and Storage Tank. So here's the problem. Let's say you're at an event where you need to take a lot of pictures. Like maybe you're at your daughter's graduation, maybe you're shooting your son's softball team. Or maybe you're on the vacation of a lifetime, and of course you want to take all, as many pictures as you can. The problem, though, is what do you do with those pictures once you fill up your memory card? I guess you could buy a whole bunch of memory cards, but who wants to carry around a bandolier full of memory cards? You could also bring your computer along and offload your pictures onto it. I don't know about you, but I very rarely take my computer around these days. With devices like smartphones and iPads, I really don't need my computer around everywhere I go. Now, you might be saying, but there's this fancy camera connection kit for the iPad. Well, that's true, but the biggest iPad is only 64 gigabytes. And what if you shoot a lot more pictures than that? I mean, these days, cameras, if you're shooting RAW, you can get huge files. In my case, at the anime conventions I go to for Otaku No Podcast, I shoot a lot of pictures in concerts and theater-type situations where it's very impractical to bring a laptop along with me. And since I subscribe to the machine gun approach of photography, that is, shoot a whole bunch of pictures hoping that one of them will come out, I tend to shoot a lot of pictures and I need to quickly offload them off of my camera's memory cards. Fortunately, there's a class of device called photo storage tanks that do just this. Basically, it's a box that contains a hard drive and one or more memory slots. Put a memory card in the slot, and it automatically gets copied onto the built-in hard drive. Later, when you get back to your computer, you plug it in via USB and offload the pictures from it onto your computer using Lightroom or Aperture or whatever. Now, there's a couple of manufacturers that make these. I've tried them all, and they all have some fatal flaw or another. Either they have really pitiful battery life, or they have Soviet-era user interface. Or, in the case of one device from Epson, they cost like twice as much as the other devices do. Well, I finally found a device that has decent battery life, a pretty good UI, and it's actually reasonably priced. It's the HyperDrive Album, made by the company that makes the HyperMac extended life batteries for the MacBooks. It's available in a wide range of capacities, starting from 160 gigabytes all the way up to 750 gigabytes. They also sell a bare unit, in other words, one without a hard drive built in, which is very handy because, for example, let's say you have a hard drive left over after you upgrade your MacBook. Well, you can buy this bare unit and install your leftover hard drive into it. Kind of cool. It has both compact flash and secure digital memory slots. So, in other words, it covers like 90% of the cameras used nowadays. If you have a camera that uses some weird format like memory stick or something, as long as you can adapt it to either compact flash or secure digital, you're fine. This thing is lightning fast. It copies an 8GB compact flash card in only about 4 minutes. And the battery life is insane. They claim that you can copy 250 gigabytes of data before the battery dies, and I found that this is pretty reliable. In practical usage, that means I can basically go for an entire day of shooting and not have to charge the battery on this thing. Unlike many devices in this category, it also has a 4.8-inch widescreen color LCD, which is gorgeous. You can use it to review the pictures that you've shot. It supports all the common formats, including many of the RAW formats from Canon, Nikon, and a variety of other manufacturers. You can look through the pictures that you shot and easily BART them. And of course, once you get back to your computer, just plug it in via USB, and you can easily offload your pictures into Aperture or whatever. Because it operates as a standard USB device, you can also use it to store any other kind of file, much like your other USB hard drives. Here's an interesting thing, though. It'll back up anything that's stored on your memory card, not just pictures. So, for example, I can use it to back up the SD cards from my Zoom H2 portable recorder. How much will all this set you back? Well, the bare unit with no hard drive, remember the one that you presumably have an extra hard drive lying around that you install into, is $299. The version that comes with a 160 gig drive built in is $399, and the price goes up from there. Believe it or not, this is actually pretty reasonable compared to other devices in this category. It may seem like a lot of money to you, but consider this. If you spent $400 worth in memory cards, you'd only get about 48 gigs of memory, whereas the same $400 would buy you the 160-gigabyte hyperdrive. When you think about it that way, it's really not that unreasonable. Find out more information and order yours today at the link that I'm sure Allison will put in the show notes. Hope you enjoyed the review, and I'll see you next time.
Well, thanks, Donald. That sounds like a really cool product. Those things are still pretty expensive, but this looks like a really slick little device for a lot of people. I was thinking maybe people could just get an iPad, but, you know, even though it's just a little bit more money, it doesn't have near the storage of the HyperDrive. So that's that looks like a pretty cool device. Thanks for letting us know.
Dumb questions.
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Steve Tren, also known as Trucker Steve, sent in a request. Now, normally I don't read the really nice praising letters. It seems kind of self-serving to do that. I love them, keep sending them, but it does seem self-serving to read out loud. But he wrapped his dumb question up in compliments, so I get to read it to you. Hi, Allison. First, I want to let you know how much I continue to enjoy the NoSillaCast. I've been along for the ride since almost the beginning. One of the things I like the most is your detailed show notes. Sometimes I'm not able to listen, but with the iPhone, the notes are just a click away. Now for the dumb question. Is there any way to search podfeet.com using the iPhone? The other day, I wanted to review your comments about a piece of software for cataloging a DVD library. I could not figure out how to find it on the iPhone. When I got home, it was simple to search the site with my MacBook. Well, let's see, he also says, if search is not available, is there any way to get it to the regular website from Mobile Safari? The website is smart enough to know I'm using an iPhone and goes straight to the mobile version. This isn't the most pressing issue, but I'm curious as to what I'm overlooking. Finally, I wanted to thank you again for all you do for the Mac community and for keeping all of us entertained and informed. Well, Steve thinks I'm absolutely amazing because I fixed this up for him in less than a day. But the reality was that I'd been planning on fixing this for ages, and I just kind of hadn't gotten around to doing it, and his email kind of pushed me to get her done. You see, the iPhone has a reasonably good web browser, but I have so much content in the sidebars and in the center that it's not really the best experience from a phone. I installed a theme ages ago that senses the mobile Safari interface, and it switches the iPhone automatically to this very simplified interface. Now, this was rockin' cool like 3 years ago, but it's pretty dated now, and I heard there were cooler ways to do it. Well, I went hunting, and almost immediately I found this perfect plugin called iWPhone from iwphone.contentrobot.com. Instantly, podfeed.com looked 10 times cooler than it ever did before. Since iWPhone is a plugin, not a theme, you have all kinds of options on tailoring the look and feel of the website as seen from a mobile device. Now, I haven't really messed with it yet, but out of the box, it looks fantastic. The great advantage of the iWPhone plugin is that you get a beautiful, compact display. It shows the date and kind of an iCal-looking button with the color changing by month so you can tell June separate from July. You get a little red number on the date showing how many comments there are for the post. And of course, that's selectable, so you can go read the comments. There's also a little down arrow to the right of the post that lets you see a few lines of the excerpt. The default view is only the title, the author, and the category, so you have to click that to see the excerpt. But once you've flipped it so you can see the excerpt, you can click a link to read the entire post. Now, so far, all I've done is make it prettier and more useful in some ways, but Steve asked for two other things that iWPhone gives us now. There's a lovely search button. I haven't tested it to see how good the search is, but at least it's there. And the other thing you get is at the bottom, it has a link to take you to the real content site. So if you need to get to the full-on site, you can do it now, which you couldn't do with the old plugin. This gives you the best of all worlds, because once you're on the real site, there's also a link at the very bottom of that, which is a very long way to scroll with my wordy posts. But if you can get yourself to the bottom, there's a link that'll take you right back to the lovely mobile version if you prefer that. Now, I have to tell you, this story isn't all sweetness and light. After I installed the plugin and I admired it and looked at how beautiful my site was, I managed to instantly break it. You see, there's an option to choose an icon for the name of the site. In my case, it says No Silicast, which I find interesting. Not sure how it got there, but it pulled that somewhere, but I like it. Anyway, you can choose this little icon to put right next to the name, and they have a set of built-in icons, or you can upload one of your own. Even though it would be very teeny and probably unrecognizable when resized, I uploaded my full-size square icon, the one you see in iTunes. And that's when things went terribly wrong. Instantly after I did this, you could see nothing at all when you went to podfeet.com on an iOS device. I was in a panic. I tweeted out asking people to test it for me, and a ton of you came to my assistance. But sadly, it was blank all across the board. Adam Christensen of the MacCast saw a chance to tease me for yet again boogering something up in WordPress, but then he told me that the guy who made the iWPhone plugin is Dale Mugford of BraveNewCode.com, who actually designed the MacCast website, and he'd be glad to get me in touch with him if I needed some help. Adam also did a faceplant with me where we noodled on the root cause of the problem. I tried uninstalling the plugin, and the problem persisted, which was very odd. Eventually, I traced my steps back to that giant image as the possible culprit. Next, I had to figure out where the iWPhone application had actually hidden that file, but once I found it and deleted it, everything looked beautiful again. So I want to give a big shout-out to Dale Mugford for a most awesome plugin, a shout-out to Adam Christensen for at least letting me cry on his shoulder, and to all of you who tested for me throughout that night till I got it working again. So, Steve, what looked like an effortless flip of a switch at your request was actually a pretty involved process and was a great example of it takes a village. Well, we have another listener contribution here. Let's hear next from Michelle on her solution to organizing her Mac.
Hello, everyone. Michelle in New York, a.k.a. Country Signs, with a quick review for you of Hazel from Noodlesoft.com for the Mac. Why am I reviewing this? Well, for a couple of reasons. One, I love using this program. I use it all the time. And better still, my computer uses the program every day, even if I never even look at it. Two, Allison guilted me into reviewing something while she was enjoying herself with Mickey. I'm not bitter at all. And three, because she asked me not to do something iPhone or iPad related, which seems to be where I've been spending most of my time lately. Okay, so back to why I love Hazel. It sits in my menu bar and actually does a few useful things, along with solving a multitude of problems. My biggest problem is my file organization. I tend to download a lot of different things to look at later, from craft ideas to music demos, along with press releases and software to look at. Before Hazel, it would all sit in my downloads folder, and when I had a minute, I would try to go through it and move stuff where it should go. And that was really time-consuming. Now the organizing is done for me. I set up Hazel to watch my downloads folder with different instructions to follow, and I forget about it. Setting up the rules were easy, similar to smart folders in iTunes. You open Hazel and press the plus sign to add a folder for it to watch. Then you press the plus sign under rules and tell it what you want it to do. You can have Hazel watch any folder in your computer or even an external hard drive. So for example, one of the rules I have is to watch for files that contain the word crochet, either in the file name or contents. And when you find one, move it to the folder Craft Ideas. Now that's just the entry-level geek action it can perform. You can also have it import photos into iPhoto or move music into iTunes. And if you want to get really geeky, it can run Apple scripts and shell scripts. This program really has saved me a ton of time. That's not all it does. It also cleans out all those pesky support files that get left behind when you delete a program. That was just a bonus I didn't even know about when I first tried the program. Now I know there are a lot of other programs that do these functions separately, but I love that Hazel combines all these actions in one program and never seems to hog resources. You can try Hazel for free for 14 days, and when you decide you can't live without it either, it's only $21.95. Hope this helped you out, Allison. And if anyone wants to find out about my other ramblings, they can follow my tweets at Country Signs or listen to my game reviews over at theportablegamer.com. And until next time, enjoy!
Well, Hazel sounds really intriguing, Michelle. I always thought Hazel from Noodlesoft.com was just for cleaning out like cache files or something like that. Are you saying that if I had Hazel, I would not have 113 items totaling 3.41 gigabytes in my downloads folder? Like I could have all my installer files magically go into my installer folder instead of pretending I was going to clean them up someday? I'm starting to see what Dean Elger complains about. This episode of the show is going to cost me a fortune, I think. $21.95 at a time. Have you ever used a software application on your Mac or PC that just makes you happy every time you use it? I feel that way about ScreenSteps. I'll be slogging through my email and I come across a question asking me how to do something, and I realize it's the perfect opportunity to bring up ScreenSteps and enjoy myself. I can walk through the steps and just snap away with the built-in screen capture tool or use another tool if I want to. I can throw in some annotations to make it perfectly clear I mean to push that button right there, a big arrow pointing at it, you know, look here. I can add in some text for flavor, and then I simply choose export to get a beautiful professional PDF tutorial. I'm absolutely serious when I say that I look forward to these opportunities. I figure if I can send my knowledge out to one other person, I've doubled my value to the company in that instance. The people I send these tutorials to fall all over themselves with gratitude. Think of the value you can bring to your company for a mere $40 for the standard edition of ScreenSteps Desktop, or if you want to go crazy, $80 for the pro version that lets you do a full-fledged manual. Of course, you could look even more brilliant when you knock 25% off of those prices by using my coupon code NOCILLA, that's my name spelled backwards in all capital letters. Head on over to ScreenSteps.com and get started saving your company money. Well, George from Tulsa is back with product reviews, updates on some information, all kinds of great stuff. We've missed you, George. Welcome back.
Poetry. Netbooks are lame. Microsoft's to blame. If you want to know why and how Microsoft crippled netbook progress, there's a couple of links in the show notes. Why was I shopping for a netbook? My daughter is starting a law school that administers exams only on Windows. I thought a netbook with a good keyboard and great battery life might be useful daily and for exams. After typing on one faster than it could keep up with the typos caused by the tiny keys, I decided my daughter needs to be along for the purchase, if purchase there is to be. Which doesn't explain why I'm now trying to like the expensive iPad, which seduced me into an impulse buy after my snobbish rejection of netbooks. At least my iPad remains shiny new. My first stop after purchase was the kiosk right outside the Apple store, where a brilliant businessman is selling and installing Zag invisible shields. That first night, I showed my shiny new zagged iPad to the wife. The good news, she didn't yell. The bad news, she went straight to the New York Times website to play Sudoku. But there's no New York Times Sudoku on the iPad because there's no flash on the iPad. No big deal. I downloaded Sudoku HD for a mere $1.99. Dawning realization. I'd been pawned by Steve Jobs. I'd just paid Apple to do something that's free on any computer with flash, no $1.99 app required. If you haven't listened to Nightwise's segment from last week's show number 268, please do. He's hilarious, and he's so right the iPad is a way to push Apple content and suck in our money. I've bought and downloaded the usual apps, Goodreader, Weatherbug, Netflix, IMDb, Kindle, QuickOffice Connect HD for Excel and Word files, Calendgoo for interactive access to my Google Apps Premier Calendar at work. Note, a lot of these apps are workarounds, the Apple restrictions. I resisted buying numbers, but the truth is, no other program comes close if you have to crunch numbers on an iPad. The numbers interface and keypad for data entry is unique and well thought out for the touchscreen. You'll have difficulty getting your data out of numbers. If you're a Mac owner and have iWork, you can email your numbers to yourself or put them on iWork.com, then open them on your computer, or even link them through an iTunes sync. From there, you can export them to Excel. There's no computer reason it has to be this way, just Apple restricting what you can do with the iPad. At this time, I've $1,000 in what Apple's unnecessary restrictions make mostly a toy. Those links about how Microsoft attacked netbook progress are pretty revealing. For about $300 more, I could have had a MacBook Air from the Apple refurb store. A MacBook Air that's a real computer. Woulda, shoulda. Allison asked about new stuff. Virgin Mobile wireless router, $150. That's the MiFi. No contract required. Ability to buy connection time in $10 increments. Works anywhere there's a decent Sprint cell connection. Check out the Virgin Mobile pricing structure if you're going to be on the road and need a more secure than hotel Wi-Fi connection. Back in December, my Nokia N900 fell off the truck just in time for show 238. It is a great tiny computer with a superior camera. I've connected it to my giant TV and browsed the net on a 60-inch screen. Native browser works flawlessly to edit Google Docs and spreadsheets. The MAMO OS and apps are often updated. But I'm donating it away because my new Nexus One with Android 2.2 is a better phone, if a lesser computer, and its seamless connection to Google Mail and Calendar is important to me. Speaking of phones, if you have an iOS 4 device, opt out of Apple's iAd tracking. Link in show notes. Remember to opt out when your iPad gets its iOS 4 update. You have to opt out from the device itself. Flush app is a free program for Macs that deletes flash cookies. Ever wonder how Amazon knows what you've browsed even after you reset Safari? Flash cookies. Delete them. In show 259, I reviewed Audiobook Builder, a program for easily ripping multi-disc CD books. It just upgraded, which makes importing audiobooks significantly easier. If you check out audiobooks from the library to rip, then listen on an iPod, get Audiobook Builder, unquestionably worth $9.95, from splasm.com, link in show notes. In show 251, I explained how to down-convert high bitrate music to save space on iPods. Last week, I noticed a click in iTunes 9.2 to elect transferring songs at 128K. Was that always there? Don't know, but it sure beats an elaborate process. Click to double the effective size of your iGadgets. Way back in show 189, I gave the thumbs down to the Western Digital MyBook 1TB Ethernet NAS. Basic objection, it runs no faster than a cheap USB drive hanging off my Apple Extreme router. That was before it crashed and trashed itself. Fortunately, all that was lost were backup files. More fortunately, there was a firmware upgrade. It has now been working fine, though not faster, for months, but my trust factor is low. Do you know it gets hot in Oklahoma? Worse, it gets hot and humid. We've been running near 100 day after day with lots of rain, raising the heat index to 110 and worse. Sure don't want to turn on the range to boil water for coffee or throw that bag of meat into the oven and heat up the house. So do what I did and get a magnetic induction hot plate. Heats just the pan and not the house. Super fast. Mine's a Max Burton 6000 currently on Amazon for $69.98. Might save enough on utility bills to pay for itself, if not that expensive iPad.
Well, thanks, George. It's always a pleasure to hear your unique view of things. Next up is our very first review from Brendan Finan, a new friend to me and I think an old friend of the show, but a new friend to me. So let's have a listen to his review.
Hi there, castaways. This is Brendan Finan from brendanfinan.com and the On Hiatus classical music podcasts, Classical Introductions and Classical Explorations. And I'm here today to review the writing app Scrivener for Mac. Well, let's keep things NosillaCast by starting with a problem to be solved. I originally discovered this app after hearing about the app Write Room, which removes the clutter and leaves you with just a text entry space, which is great for ignoring distractions. And when you're writing something big like a novel, you want to avoid distractions, right? Well, yes, but you might also want to manage several drafts of your document. In fact, if you're writing a long piece, chances are you will want to do that. You're also going to want to make notes and synopses, and depending on the kind of thing you're writing, you might also be making extensive or not so extensive research notes. And then once you have all that stuff, you have to keep it organized. Well, Scrivener is here to solve all these problems. It operates in a three-pane layout, with the center pane containing your latest masterpiece, while the left pane takes care of navigation and the right lets you add notes, synopses, bookmarks, labels to remind you what you're working with, like, say, a chapter or a new character or idea or whatever, and even more. What it does, basically, is create a document folder, all the documents of which you can access right there in the main window. So all of your drafts, chapters, research notes, scribbles, sketches, and ideas are in the same place. This is a lifesaver to the perpetually disorganized writer. For me, though, Scrivener's real power lies in its built-in research section. You can interact with it in exactly the same way as with your text, but your research can be anything. PDFs, photos, music, video, whatever you like. So if you went to all the trouble of Googling that list of species of turkeys in Uzbekistan, then you can save the file to your research section and you won't have to go back online to find it again. And if you want to keep an eye on your research while you're writing, well, you can do that too. There's a great split-screen view that you can enable so that you can watch your research in one window while you type in another, or watch your earlier draft while you type the new one, or pretty much store any two windows in at the same time. Oh, and speaking of drafts, it's also got this neat little feature called Snapshots, which basically allows you to, well, to take a snapshot of what your document looks like right now so that you can make big changes without worrying about losing anything. Should you decide later that you like the first version better, getting it back can be done at the push of a button. And given that I found my way to Scrivener by way of a full-screen text editor, I was really pleased to find that Scrivener lets you do that too. Hit Command-Option-F and you're taken to a nice full-screen view without the painful distractions of Twitter, Facebook, email, or whatever your preferred social networking tools are. there are a couple of other features which I thought were really clever and which aren't really trumpeted by the Scrivener team. The first is a live word count, which is an absolute blessing, especially if you're going for a certain target. I know my biggest distraction when I was writing essays during college was pulling down the file menu over and over to check my word count, so it's great to get rid of that. The second is a word frequency check, which watches your vocabulary so you can check if you're using the word opulent too often. And the last of my favourite features is autosave, which activates every time you leave the document alone for 2 seconds. Given the variety of ways you can access the old versions of your files, like with snapshots, this cannot be a bad thing. You can still save manually, but any time I've gotten as far as pressing Command S, the app has already done the job for me. How nice. So is it all smiles and sunshine? Well, not quite. I did have a few issues with it. The first is that you can't import files from OpenOffice.odt files. You can export to them, but if you're importing, you kind of have to find a workaround. I found this a little bit annoying, but I suppose I'm in the minority as an exclusive OpenOffice user. I also had some very small niggles with the user interface, just little annoyances where it didn't quite do what I expected it to, but that may just be my experience. So anyways, do you need Scrivener? Well, put it this way. If you're writing some long documents with several chapters where you need notes and loads of different bits of information brought together and organized, then Scrivener is the app for you. If, on the other hand, you're only writing in little bursts, then you can probably do just fine with something like WriteRoom or even a typical word processor. And if you're not a writer, then you probably should have just skipped this review. I should have told you that at the beginning. Scrivener is available for $39.95 from the wonderfully named website literatureandlatte.com. If you're not sure if you'll need it, there's a 30-day free trial available, and that's 30 days of use, by the way, so if you open it on day one and then leave it alone for a month, you still have 29 days of your trial left. And my verdict, if you haven't guessed, highly recommended for writers, everyone else, ignore freely.
Well, Brendan, that was really, really interesting. I've heard a lot about Scrivener, but never a compelling reason why I wanted to use it. I got to tell you, that auto word count thing when you said that, I was always looking for whatever distraction in college. I'm always looking for every distraction now. The ability to cover up Twitter is certainly a good thing. I've tried quitting it, but I just find myself turning it back on. I like the idea of the word frequency count. There's some authors I'd really like to do that, to have them check that. I don't know about you, but I'll notice that they say one word over and over again, and then it drives me nuts through the rest of the book. But yeah, it sounds like a great tool for keeping the ADD at bay. Well, just recently, I've had a few very entertaining and complimentary emails from British student Mark Fawcett, and he decided to give back by sending in a review of his own.
Hello. I'm Mark Fawcett from England, and today I'd like to share with you a quick review of Cinch, or maybe Kinch, C-I-N-C-H. But first, that proverbial problem. A while ago, I think Alison mentioned a not too unpleasant experience with Windows 7. I think we're going to see a lot more of Windows 7 in the future. For example, the tool warehouse where I work during the summer is almost entirely now on 7, whereas 2 years ago, there was a Windows 95 machine still in goods in, which was completely terrifying. Anyway, 7 is much, much better than its grandfather Windows XP, and even businesses think so. So perhaps we alternative computer users need to get to grips with Windows and learn how to move from Windows to Mac and back as seamlessly as possible. Windows has made some strides in this area. Search is now much better, and the new dock is brilliant compared to the old taskbar. But you may still want to install something like WizMouse from antibodysoftware.com to get scrolling while hovering over Windows with your cursor, rather than the constant clicking. It came to me the other day while using a Microsoft mouse that they make quite a lot of mouses. So all this clicking may be a bit of a conspiracy to get us to wear out those mouses. But anyway, you may want to install something like Switcher, which gives you something like Exposé on Windows. But have you ever considered it maybe your Mac that needs some help in the multi-platform world? If I remember correctly, Alison might have found the AeroSnap feature of Windows quite useful. For those of you that don't know what AeroSnap is, it's a new feature of Windows 7 allowing you to maximise a window by dragging it to the top of the screen and letting go. It pops into full screen in a lovely organic way and is, I think, slightly more natural than clicking the maximise button. Better still, if you drag a window to either the right or left hand side of the screen, it springs up into taking up exactly half, right or left, of the screen. This is so useful when comparing two documents. I find I use it over and over again at work. It's so much easier than dragging a window to the left and then dragging it to the bottom corner to resize and then moving it around again and then doing the same on the right side. Just, oh, trust me, once you've had this, you can't go back. So this is where the review comes in. Cinch is a tiny map program that you can set to open at login. It mimics AeroSnap on your Mac. Dragging any window to any edge of the screen will cause a pretty grey box animation indicating where that window will snap to. Letting go of the mouse then causes a snap. It works with the left and right and top of the screen and the results are identical to Aero. Moving the window away from the side or top of the screen causes it to return to its original size. And that's about it. All it does. End of review? Not quite. Now I know some of you will be wondering about how this works with spaces. Moving a window, after all, from space to space involves dragging it to the edge of the screen. Just like Cinch? Well, not quite. Changing spaces involves a pause of about half a second, or maybe even a second, just a tad too long, I think. Cinch works differently. You drag the window to the edge and then let go. You can go as quickly as you like, and you don't have to wait for the pretty grey box to expand or anything. So, depending on how quick you are with the mouse, you could maybe do that in a tenth of a second. So Cinch plays really nicely with spaces. Drag a window to the edge, wait for a second and spaces will move your window, or drag a window to the left and don't wait, and Cinch will resize your window. Now, obviously, Cinch can't expand a window that can't be resized. Dragging system preferences, for example, to the top of the screen again causes the grey box animation, but with a sort of no entry sign, letting you know that this window can't be resized. I haven't tested Cinch with multiple displays, but the developer explains how you can make it work. Obviously, there's no edge to bang into with the mouse with multiple displays, but if you move your mouse across the boundary slowly, Cinch still works. A more ingenious solution, however, is to have your monitor slightly skewed, that way creating small ledges at the top and bottom, which you can bump into and therefore allow Cinch to work normally. When you're on Cinch for the very first time, a very simple window appears, letting you decide whether you want Cinch to start at login, show in the menu bar, check for updates and so on. Now, the menu bar icon lets you quit or disable Cinch. I don't really see the point in disabling Cinch, so I don't include the menu bar item. I do, however, set it to open at login. It's in a list of only 4 login items on my computer, so I hope you can understand how important it must be. Now, Cinch is priced at $7, which I think is a little expensive, but if I were to lose it, I would buy it again in a heartbeat. There's a free trial, which I wouldn't recommend if you don't intend to purchase, as you will miss it when it's gone. Cinch can be found at irradiatedsoftware.com. And finally, thank you so much, Alison, for producing this podcast. It must take such a lot of work, but it really is worth it. Thanks again. P.S. If you thought this review was rubbish, sound quality bad, too long, etc., then you are to tell Alison off. I did tell her not to include it if she thought it was bad.
Okay, Mark, you are certifiable. You slay me. That was hilarious. Of course it was fantastic. Nobody yell at me because it was a good review. Everybody in the chat room says they really liked it. So I would like to really point out that this is great. Now you cost me another $7. Let's see, I'm out $30 for Scrivener, $21.95 for whatever it was Michelle told me to buy. This is costing me a fortune. All right. Let's see. Hazel. That's what it was. I got to finish buying Hazel too. But anyway, I don't care what you say. I think you did a great review. Well, we have one last listener savior coming up. Chris, I'm going to go with Eschweiler, I think the way you'd pronounce it. He sent in his first review for the show, but I suspect he's not actually new at broadcasting. It's that good. Let's have a listen.
Hi, Allison. Chris Eschweiler from chrisesch.com. I thought I'd submit my review for this week's show to support the Podfeet staycation at Disneyland. The problem I have came up recently, and it's not an uncommon one. One of my clients was having problems mounting a couple of LaCie 1TB external drives that they use as backups. As many people have also experienced, the problem manifests itself as a failure of the drive to mount, and is often accompanied by a blinking blue indicator on the front face of the drive. Now, one possible solution is to use either a replacement power supply or at least a known good power supply. In our case, however, using a known good power supply from other units in the office didn't solve the problem. Being that both these drives were duplicates of each other, I felt fairly safe venturing into the realm of data recovery. I found posts on various forums that said a product from R-Tools Technology called R-Studio over at www.data-recovery-software.net had allowed others who'd suffered the same problem with their externally powered LaCie drives to recover their data. After a bit of research, I typed in my credit card number and downloaded a copy of R-Studio for Mac. Now, the LaCie Big Disk Extremes are not a typical hard drive in a fancy enclosure. The 1TB unit uses two 500GB Seagate SATA drives in a RAID 0 configuration to produce a large, single storage device. The problem is, you can't just take these drives out of their enclosure, attach them to an external interface, and have them mount on your Mac. The Mac has no idea how to deal with two drives that were formatted to be handled as one in a LaCie enclosure. The first thing I had to do was remove the drives from the enclosure and, using a couple of SATA to USB docks I bought at a local computer supply store, connect them to my Mac. However, being part of a RAID, the drives didn't mount on the desktop, and the finder asked if I wanted to initialize them. Be very careful. If you're following along, you do not want to initialize these drives. That process erases the drives, which is not what I was trying to accomplish here, so I bypassed that message. With the drives connected, I launched my copy of the $79.99 RStudio for Mac. After putting in my administrator's password, I was presented with the RStudio interface. Now, this is a no-nonsense utility. There are action buttons across the top of the interface. Below that, there are two panes, side by side. The left pane is a device/disk list that shows all the drives connected to the computer. In here, I could see my MacBook Pro's drives as well as the two drives from the LaCie. One was named with what I think was a Seagate number, ST and a bunch of digits following it, and the second drive was listed as generic 1.something. More on this in a moment. Moving over to the right side of the interface, in the right pane you get details of whatever you have selected back in the left pane, and below both panes spans a log window. Now to begin, I clicked the Create Virtual RAID button pull-down and chose Create Virtual Block RAID. There are two other options in that drop-down, but this one made sense as I was trying to recreate the RAID that had existed in the LaCie enclosure. Once I made my selection, another drive listing appeared in the program's left pane, showing that I had effectively added another storage device to my Mac. But there was no data on this new device. It was time to add the Seagate drives to the new virtual block RAID. I dragged the two Seagate drives down one at a time and dropped them into the listing for the virtual RAID. There is a trick to this, however. I discovered that I needed to add the drive with the Seagate number, the ST number, into the virtual block RAID listing first, then drag the generic drive in after that. Drive order is important, but it is pretty simple to change the order if you need to. So, once I had the drives included in the virtual block RAID, I went to the right-hand pane to make some suggested tweaks. First, I confirmed that I had the new device set for RAID 0. The next drop-down allowed me to set block size. The default was 64 kilobytes, which didn't work for me. I tried the next option, which was 128 kilobytes, and that setting did work for me. Some accounts on the internet have said to use either the 256 kilobyte or the 512 kilobyte options, but your mileage may vary. I left the other two dropdowns in their defaults and hit the Apply button. This tells the RStudio software that you're done adding drives, and RStudio now builds your virtual RAID in about 15 seconds. With the new RAID showing up in the left-hand panel as a new single device, I scrolled down and found a listing under the new RAID for Apple HFS Plus Extended. Clicking on that listing yielded a beautiful sight. All of the folders and files that my client feared they'd lost from the backup appeared in a list view. To the left of each item in the directory was a checkbox. Here I could select the directories and files I wanted to recover. After making my selections, I clicked RStudio's Recover Marked button at the top of the program window. Once I selected a new destination to save the files to, RStudio began the process of copying the recovered files onto the other hard drive. This isn't a fast operation, by the way. It takes a bit of time for the software to rebuild the files and folders. What it's doing is reassembling blocks scattered across two different drive mechanisms back into one contiguous file. All told, it took between 8 and 10 hours to get over 900 gigabytes of files off the old RAID. But it worked. I recovered all the data my client feared they'd lost, and at a modest cost compared to an actual commercial drive recovery service. What did I learn? I learned that data recovery can be accomplished in a pretty straightforward manner at a very reasonable $79 price tag. RStudio for the Mac is a great tool and a great one to have in your arsenal of software utilities, especially if you have an externally powered LaCie drive. I hope this review of our technologies, RStudio for Mac, was helpful. If you have any questions or comments, you can contact me at headhoncho@chrisesch.com.
Well, thanks, Chris. This was really interesting. I have to admit, I went back through and reread the show notes you gave us after listening once straight through to make sure I understood exactly what it was you were doing. I'm really intrigued that RStudio could actually see these drives, even though they weren't technically mounted yet, before you created the virtual RAID for them. This sounds like a tool that Pat Dingler should own for her Your Mac Doctor business, that's for sure. She could get a lot of use out of this. Thanks again for a great review. Well, as you know, my eye has wandered of late from the straight and narrow life of Honda and Acura. I admit that I've been lusting over the Tesla Model S, looking at photos, reading the specs, dreaming of colors I'd buy. But in reality, I won't buy a car that isn't a Honda or an Acura. I simply won't do it, because I'd have to pick out a second mechanic in my life. Yep, I've only had one mechanic since I bought my first car in 1978, 32 years ago. I found Honda Bob, and I don't even remember how I found Honda Bob, and while I might have had the wandering eye for the hot emerald green Camaro from time to time, I've never been tempted to go to another Honda mechanic. If you'd like to have that kind of faith in your mechanic, and of course you drive a Honda or an Acura and you live in the LA or Orange County areas, then give him a call at 562-531-2321 or shoot him an email at hdabob@aol.com. H.A. Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. What's that time of the week again? It's time for chit-chat across the pond with BartB.ie. How are you today, Bart?
Hey, I'm supposed to be Bart Bush. That's from BartB.ie.
Oh, what did I call you? Just Bart?
Just called me BartB.ie. I am a website.
Well, it's not like a website. It's not like I've been doing this for a while or something. I've been out of town. I've been at Disneyland. I've been goofing off, doing no work. I'm off my game.
Yeah, how did you get back from Disneyland so quick? Oh, or is there more than one?
No, it's just like 45 minutes away. Well, yeah, there's Disney World down in Florida.
Oh, right.
Maybe you're thinking of that. Yeah, no, we were just out in Anaheim, so.
I see. I thought city old me. I just thought there was one in Florida, and one in Paris. I don't know there anymore.
The original one's Orlando in California. Well. Yeah, the original one's California, actually.
Oh.
That's where Mickey
goes to show what I know. Does it have a big castle?
Yes, it do.
That's all that matters then.
There you go. It was a lot of fun, but we probably should get started. So what do we got going for Security Light? We got a couple of things, don't we?
Yeah, all related to one company. They live in Redmond.
Uh-oh.
Which I think is in Washington.
Yes.
But not the one where DC is. Just to confuse everything. Anyway, last Tuesday was Patch Tuesday. We said there were going to be four critical updates, and there were four critical updates. So if you haven't done so already, update your machines, wake your VMs, and remember that you have a netbook behind the couch.
Oh, right. Actually, I do have a netbook I need to remember to do. Good job.
Okie dokie. Then, not so good news, and this is following the old pattern. So Patch Tuesday has been and gone, so what should come shortly after Patch Tuesday? Why? Microsoft Zero Day Vulnerability, of course.
That wasn't just patched.
Of course not. So the bad guys kept it until just after Patch Tuesday and then went to town. So unfortunately, this one's kind of serious. The US Computer Emergency Readiness Team, or US CERT as I prefer to call them because it's easier, are warning that this one is being actively exploited. There is no patch, but there are workarounds.
Ooh.
So basically the US CERT article is listed in the show notes. It gives you nice instructions on the various workarounds.
Oh, but it's got regedit in the instructions.
No. Note, see Microsoft Knowledge Base article to use the automated Microsoft Fix-It solution.
Okay. All right. I was going to say, I'm reading the instruction going, all you got to do is open up your regedit, go to HK classes root link file shell x icon handler. Okay. We'll
this one is actually kind of scary. If you display a link, basically this thing works by being a malicious link. So a shortcode file, as you normally call them. On your hard disk, they're .lnk files, but you see them as shortcuts with that little arrow icon. Simply displaying one of those icons, if it was provided by the bad guy, is enough to execute any code they like. And if you have autorun installed on your system, that means that simply plugging in a USB stick is enough to spread the virus.
Do you have to have done it through a USB stick, or could you have downloaded it, or...
No, it can come to you anyway, but because autorun is enabled by default, if you plug in a CD or you stick in a thumb drive, or even if you connect to a network share, autorun will execute. You could trick people a million and one ways. It just has to be displayed. It doesn't even have to be in Windows Explorer. You just have to display the linked. You have to display the malicious LNK file in a Windows Explorer type window, be it in an open dialog, be it in a save dialog, be it anywhere, and that's enough to trigger the vulnerability to run.
Now they said
just seeing them.
Disabling autorun just increases the amount of user interaction required to trigger the vulnerability. It doesn't block it. It just makes it less likely it'll happen automatically.
Yes, but that's the second thing in their list of things. So the first thing is disable the displaying of icons for shortcuts.
So
if you don't see your shortcuts, then you can't see them to cause the error to run.
But that means you can't see your shortcuts.
It does, but it's better than being hacked.
Oh, my gosh.
This one's serious. This is being used actively by malware to spread itself.
What damage does it do if you get it, though?
Well, anything. It's a way to get in. It allows the bad guys to run any code they like. So whatever they'd like to do, be it steal your credit cards, be it take over your computer, be it subscribe your computer to a botnet, whatever it is they'd like to do that you'd rather they didn't, they can do.
Great.
Yeah, it's big news.
So this is just to hold you over, though. Is to
These workarounds are to protect you. Now, the nice thing with the Microsoft Fixit solution is that it has an on and an off button, so you can enable the fix or enable the sort of workaround for now. Wait till Microsoft patch it, and then go back and disable it, so that everything's back the way you left it.
Now, I don't see in the show notes it's saying which ones, which versions are vulnerable.
That is a good point. What does Microsoft have to say on the matter?
Because
their security advisory is also linked.
Yeah, I went to
affected.
That. Nothing.
XP, Service Pack 3, XP64, Server 2003, Server 2008, Vista, Windows 7, and Server 2008. The lot.
All.
Yeah, I think we can safely describe that as all.
I thought 7 was more secure. I thought we were done with this. I keep hoping to hear you say, well, this is just for, you know, XP or just for Vista or something.
7 makes it harder for some types of bad thing to happen.
Okay.
But because this runs the nasty code as you, none of Windows 7's protections can kick in because you can do whatever you can do.
I guess. So you have to have been mailed this link file, this shortcut file, or got it on a USB stick, or...
Well, it could come in pretty much any way that a file could come in. So maybe if the big danger, I guess, is if it gets into one machine in a network, all you would have to do would be browse to that machine on a file share. So in work, it could spread like wildfire.
Okay.
If it gets into your office, your Windows shares, then it could really go around like no one's business.
All right. Well, that's depressing. But
unfortunately.
Stay tuned for a fix for that, hopefully, not just an avoidance method.
Yeah. The avoidance method will keep you safe, but it's going to inconvenience you. Not disconvenience. That's a funny word. It'll inconvenience you, though. But at least you can easily undo it with the Fixit link.
Right. Okay. Any more fun?
Well, there's another one. I'm not sure if it technically counts as security anything, but it's one of those just bear in mind for your own safety ones. We all know that if you buy something in the iTunes store and then you buy something again a minute or two later, you don't have to enter your password a second time.
Right.
Because it caches it for a small amount of time.
Which is handy.
It's handy, but it's not just for buying things that it's cached. It's also cached for in-app purchases. So this was triggered by a poor guy who had bought an app, then handed his iPad or iPhone to his kid. He then proceeded to run up a bill of $190 on in-app purchases because at no point did it ask for the password again for the next 5 or 10 minutes.
You can see that happening, handing it to a buddy of yours, too. It wouldn't have to be a 7-year-old.
Yeah. So be careful. Just because it's not asking you for your password doesn't mean it's not taking your money. It will pop up a prompt that says, you know, are you sure? But what's the kid going to do? Am I sure? Sure, I'm sure.
Absolutely. So is there anything we're supposed to do about this?
Just know about it. Hmm. If you know that it could happen, then you're less likely to have it happen and not realize.
Well, how? I mean, so I know it happens, but I have to wait 15 minutes before I hand it to somebody else? Is that part of it?
Well, certainly to someone you don't trust. Or you simply supervise your kid for a couple of minutes.
Yeah. How long does it cache it?
I don't know.
That would be good to know, wouldn't it?
It would, wouldn't it?
Oh, caching the password for 15 minutes. Apple reduces the significant annoyance of typing passwords. I do like that feature.
It is nice. Yeah, I like it too. But 15 minutes worth of danger zone.
Yeah. The time it comes in really handy for me is I like to, as soon as I go to look for an application, invariably there's 14 updates. So I'll tell it to do the updates and then go right back into the App Store and then start doing my browsing for what it was I was going to go buy or download. So
yeah.
All right.
So as I say, it's 15 minutes. It's just to be aware. I mean, it's difficult to run up giant bills, but nonetheless, $190 is enough.
Yeah, that would be irritating.
Exactly.
All right, so we do have a security light dumb question.
Yes. I don't read well, so after you.
All right, this is from David Bogdan, a teacher who likes the show out of Japan. He says, "Hello, Allison. I hope you had a good 4th. As you might imagine, it's not celebrated in any big way here in Japan, at least not where I live. I have a concern about local shared objects, LSO, or flash cookies, which might actually fall under a security light issue. I hope it's not one that you and Bart have already discussed and I missed. I try to clear out my cache in Safari pretty regularly to get rid of cookies and the like, but I just ran across a mention of where so-called flash cookies don't get dumped and are stored in Tilde Library Preferences Macromedia Flash Player folder. There are several folders in there, and I was wondering if you and or Bart would know which, if any, of the following would be safe to delete or get rid of these cookies. I've got Click to Flash going in Safari, so imagine a lot of the sites there from before I installed that. And he found, Pound Security, Pound Shared Objects, Macromedia.com, and www.macromedia.com. Are these a security issue, and should I be messing around in there? Also, I think they said Adobe Air applications do the same thing, but I couldn't find any preferences for that. I'm wondering now if there are other hidden cookies or other telltale around that cache clearing doesn't cover. Still enjoying the podcast as always, David."
Okay, bad news, David, we did talk about it before.
The good news is you remembered that we talked about it before.
And that your new site search works fantastically well.
Yay! It came in handy.
It came in most handy.
Back us up a little bit, though. I've never played around with deleting cookies of any kind. Why? Start from the beginning. Why do I care about that?
Some people would like to know where you go. Okay, well, let's back up even further.
Everyone.
What is a cookie?
Okay.
So, in theory, the internet is completely stateless. It has no idea who you are when you come back. It has no idea that you 5 minutes from now was the same you that was there 5 minutes ago. No concept of any sort of continuity at all. Which means that it would be physically impossible to do any sort of anything on the net that involves logging in or having some sort of history of even one or two page clicks, so you couldn't do any e-commerce. So they had to find a way around that limitation. And the way it works is that the web server gives your browser a token, which is called a cookie, and it says, "The next time you talk to me, give me back that token so I know who you are."
Okay.
And that's all tokens. The web server hands them to your browser, and your browser hands them back to the web server next time it talks to that same server. And the cookie can contain some information, but that's up to the server, and it probably doesn't contain anything of any interest to you. It's just a way for the server to know who you are.
All right.
That is very useful, and that makes logging in and most of the modern internet possible. But cookies can't just come from the site you're visiting. If they could, it would be a lot better. But third parties can also inject cookies. So you can visit google.com, and they can stick in a cookie for doubleclick.com.
Right. I remember there was a problem with that, in fact, wasn't there? The New York Times had it.
Sure. So the issue arises that when these third-party cookies allow people to spy on you, because they any site that tries to put in a double-click cookie means that DoubleClick can see that it's the same you that was at the other site that tried to stick in a DoubleClick cookie. And because DoubleClick is so ubiquitous with its ads everywhere and stuff, they can literally follow you around the internet and profile you and build up a picture of who you are and then target you for advertising or whatever they'd like.
Okay. I'm not as freaked out about targeted advertising as many people.
Sure, that would be a good way to put these to it, but people could be using this for anything. Use the blackmail you, for goodness sake.
Oh, okay.
They're spying on you.
All right.
Whether or not you want to be spied on is another thing, but that's what's happening with some of these cookies.
Okay.
So they're called tracking cookies, and that has people annoyed. So a lot of browsers now don't allow third-party cookies. It's an option you can disable in Firefox. And I think you can in Safari and other browsers too, or you just nuke your cookies from time to time, and then the problem kind of goes away too.
Okay.
Or you can install Firefox extensions that sort of ask you for permission, like pop-ups do in Firefox. You can get very carried away with this kind of stuff.
Okay.
But, you know, cleaning out your cookies is something people know about. And because people know about it, the people who want to spy on you know that cookies aren't so great anymore after all. So in comes Flash, which has now become ubiquitous and almost everywhere on the internet. So you can reliably assume that a desktop computer with a web browser has Flash. Flash isn't a part of the browser. It's separate. It's a plugin. So the browser hands over control to Flash. So Flash also has a cookie. It's the same thing as a cookie. It just happens to be called a local stored or local shared object, or an LSO, or a Flash cookie. But it's the same idea. And because Flash isn't a part of your browser, when you clear your cookies in the browser, Flash is completely untouched, because Flash is not part of the browser. So all these people who are cleaning their cookies, well, the bad guys have simply switched to Flash cookies instead, which aren't being cleaned out. So they get to track you.
So actually, David's pretty clever having noticed this.
Yes, there was a big expose. It hit the news about a year ago. A little less than a year, about 11 months ago, which is when it was on the show last time. And the reason it was on the show then was because I think it was the New York Times had done a big expose on it. The security world had known about it. Security Now had talked about it a year before that, in October 2008. But it hadn't really hit the mainstream until that big article came out about a year ago.
Okay.
Now, you can clean out your Flash cookies. You just have to do it separately. Adobe don't make it particularly easy. But we've linked in the show notes to the previous show notes, and in there's a link that you can go to. It's a long link, macromedia.com/support/documentation/en/flashplayer/help/settings_manager07.html. If you go there, there's a button saying clear Flash cookies.
Oh.
Now, why you'd go to a website to clear your Flash cookies, I don't know, but that's how Adobe thought to do it.
But you could keep that in your in your browser menu bar and just touch it every once in a while when you feel like it.
Yes. Or there's a plugin for Firefox called Better Privacy, which gives you a button to do it.
Oh.
Or you can set it to do it automatically. So you can actually set Better Privacy to nuke your Flash cookies every time you close the browser, which has some side effects, because anything in Flash that needs to remember your state will completely forget.
What kind of things would need to remember your state in Flash? Games?
Games, yeah. Okay. They'll know what level you're on, that kind of thing.
Okay.
Because without those, then your best scores would be gone and you wouldn't know what level you were at last and that kind of thing.
Okay.
So again, it's for saving state, but also it's being used to track you. So you'll have basically a 1 pixel by 1 pixel bit of Flash embedded that's the same color as the web page, so it's completely invisible, and all it does is insert a Flash cookie.
Hmm.
So that's pretty much the state of things. The other question then is air.
Cookies in my... I just found it finally in Firefox. I've got thousands. They're all over the place.
Absolutely. Everyone's constantly trying to track you. Everywhere you go, there's people trying to keep an eye on you.
When I went into that folder that he called out of where the Flash Player cookies are, I found one from Big in Virginia. He's tracking me. His posterous blog.
It's probably an ad or something that was in there. I mean, goodness knows why people want to track you. And also, blogs like to stick in a cookie so that when you come back... You know the way it'll automatically populate who you are, your name and stuff when you go to comment again? That's a cookie.
Mm.
Cookies do a lot of good stuff, but they also do a lot of less good stuff.
Okay.
Now, AIR was also mentioned. error local apps. Local apps need to store state. So I don't really see how, if you delete the state of local apps, it's as if you've uninstalled them. So I don't think that's a wise thing to do.
All right. So, like, yeah, an example would be there's a Twitter client, Twirl, that was an Adobe Air app, and you're saying if you cleared the cookies, then it wouldn't know how to log you in and see what your lists are and all those different things, right?
Yeah, it would completely forget everything about you because you've just erased its memory. And on a locally installed app, it'd be a bit like nuking the registry in Windows. All of your apps would forget everything about you.
Okay.
Which is not good. So in the case of Air, I don't think they're an issue. I think they're needed because otherwise Air apps can't work and you shouldn't install an Air app you don't trust.
Okay. I don't know how to tell whether you trust an Air app, though.
Well, if you see the whole internet full of people saying do not install whatever majigger app because it's a virus, that'd be a good reason not
maybe
to.
Maybe not, maybe not. Okay.
That's really kind of all you can do, to be honest.
This is Honda Bob gave me a cookie. I mean, not in a good way.
Why wouldn't he? His website would have.
Yeah, but why?
You visited, haven't you?
Yeah.
It's WordPress.
Oh, okay.
So if you've ever posted a comment or in any way interacted with the website, it will have stuck a cookie in.
Okay. I got you. All right. Well, this is good. Is there anything else on that?
I don't think so. We talked about it in much more excruciating detail back in episode 220. So if you want to go back to episode, if you want to get some really in-depth stuff, then I would definitely go back to 220 and have a listen.
Yeah, that was a while ago. It was actually George from Tulsa that brought us that.
Yes, it was. And what he also noticed is security light, nothing to report here this week. I haven't seen that one. Well.
Right. Okay, good. So now on to our main topic of the day.
Yes, so we sort of
teased it.
Teased, yeah, that's the word. I was going to say previewed or demoed, but that's not really true. We teased it. So there is a lot of talk of late. You hear it all over the place. The iPad is going to replace the Mac. OS 10.6 is going to be the last version of OS 10 ever. There's never going to be an OS 11.
The Mac is dead.
Mac is dead. Yeah, that's pretty much the refrain. And everyone pretty much hit panic stations when Apple didn't have an award for Mac software at this year's WWDC.
And that came right on the heels of Steve Jobs at D8.
Yes.
And it's been frustrating to me to hear people talk about it, because having actually been there, he didn't say that at all. What he actually said was, first of all, he talked about things like, I can imagine a day when you'll edit video on a handheld computer. And this was, of course, right before he came out with they came out with the iPhone 4 that where you could edit video on your phone. So, of course, he was talking about something that was going to happen in 10 minutes and not the future of the Mac is dead. He didn't say that.
He'd probably played with it that morning.
Right. And I mean, so many things, if you look back 10 years ago and look at us today, you would have never believed you could do that on what is now an iPad or an iPhone. So that was part of what he said. And the other thing that he said was he talked about basically saying that the PC is going to become like the truck is today, where the truck has value in the heavy lifting world. But in the old days when we were all rural, everything was a truck. And now he's saying now you've got cars and trucks because you don't need trucks for everything. So he never said.
And you also have more cars than trucks.
Right, except the best-selling car in America for like 10 years has been the Ford F-150, which is a giant truck, which I don't know. I don't know who buys them. I haven't ever met somebody who owned one, but they're everywhere. So I think what he was trying to say was you'll still need the powerhouse, but if you watch the evolution of what's happened in the last 5 years, I mean, the percentage of computers that are laptops has gone up dramatically, right? I mean, it used to be, 5% laptops and everybody else had a desktop, and then...
Well, it was 0% laptops.
Sure, at one point, right. But then, and the other thing is a lot of the power users are now using iMacs, which are not big, giant, fat desktops either. You know, they're a lighter version.
They're
that's
big,
not
though.
Well, they're big, but they're not upgradable. They're not all those things that we always said we had to have in a big tower, right? I mean, you're an iMac user. Steve's an iMac user.
You can't change your own oil in your truck anymore, either.
Yeah, you can. Can't you?
I don't know. Everything's all computerized these days.
No, you can change
the timing.
You can change the oil. Steve changes our oil, so that
you're not going to change your own gearbox.
Okay, there you go. But so, I mean, I think they're evolving away from the pure old time desktop model, and we used to think, oh well, you could never do, you know, serious video editing on an iMac, but now you can.
Yeah, that was just because processors on, you know, compact machines couldn't do the work. The iMac, I think, is actually a very interesting one to talk about because in terms of the amount of space taken up by the computer bit, it's shrunk massively.
Right.
In terms of the amount of space given over to showing us a giant big screen so that we can get a lot of work done, it's ballooned massively.
Gone the other way around, right?
It's completely gone the other way around. So it's not really about being big and having big computery bits physically. It's about the interface and giving us a really big way to interact with the computer and giving us a very powerful operating system. So that, in that sense, the PC has a massive future. The PC, in the sense of a tower with interchangeable bits that you can swap out at your will, I think that's gone.
Yeah, okay, so are we going to...
That's not the important bit.
Are we going to include laptops as PCs? Because I haven't used... Because I haven't used a desktop as my primary computer or even a secondary computer in like 7 years.
Wow, I couldn't do that.
How come? I've got fast processors and a giant monitor to hook it up to when I need it.
I suppose with a docking station I could.
Docking stations are stupid.
But you know what I mean, the concept of docking it, whether you do it through Apple's magic three-way plug or...
Right, I mean, I walk up and go, tick, 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 and I'm in. Why do I need it? Yeah, and the docking station...
That's a docking station to me.
Okay, fine. But yeah, so, I mean, a big monitor is definitely important for a lot of work, but I don't need the power of an iMac. I've got the power of a MacBook Pro. So what's to say it can't go that extra step?
There's no difference in the power of an iMac and the power of a MacBook Pro.
Right. So if I don't know whether we consider a laptop to be a high-powered machine.
Laptop's a PC.
Okay.
To me, it's not actually about the megahertz. To me, it's about the operating system.
Hmm.
The iOS and OS X, they may have the same heart, but they're fundamentally
very
different. Oh, yeah. They're completely different machines trying to do completely different things. I mean, you just can't compare them.
Right.
And it's, you know, one of them is trying to be a fast, easy to use, no maintenance, no bother way of doing simple tasks.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is trying to be a utilitarian vehicle that can do pretty much anything you can dream up.
Right.
Truck, car. Even if they make an iPad and they give it 400 gigs of RAM and they give it 5 squillion megahertz, as long as it's running an iPad-like operating system with an iPad-like interface, it will be a car. It will be a bloody fast car. It will be a Tesla Roadster of some sort, but it'll be a car.
I think I see where you're going. So you've got programs on the Mac that go from, you know, Final Cut Express or Final Cut, where it's got, you know, tremendous and total control, down to the overly dumbified iMovie, in Steve's opinion. And what I see evolving with things like the iPad is it's all this over-dumbified iPhone or iMovie version of things.
So I'll go further.
Okay.
The Mac OS X comes with scripting as one of its most important features. That's what really sets it apart. The fact that I have a terminal to go down to, the fact that I have AppleScript, the fact that I have Automare and these kind of things. They're the kind of power features that you're just not going to get elsewhere. They allow anyone who is an IT professional to build their own software without all that much trouble.
Well,
you're not going to get that on an iPad.
So are you saying that the software developers who make all my cool freeware and shareware apps on my Mac have to have scripting and terminal access to do their jobs?
Well, programmers, it's about what the environment's for. OS X is for being manipulated. iOS is for delivering stuff.
I think to the mainstream user, though,
that's where Steve Jobs is coming in. Most people are car users, not truck drivers.
Okay, but I'm just even saying on the Mac. Let's take pre-iPad iPhone days. Mm-hmm. I like going in the terminal. I like dinking around trying to see if I can figure out how to make a script. But as high-end of a user as I am, I'm nowhere near the level of user that requires those things to exist. So
sure.
I'm saying even within the truck world, I think 95% of people don't need those things at all. Those aren't critical to the experience in any way.
Okay, but then you also have the powerful multitasking features. It's a very different kind of environment to work in.
Picture battery power efficiencies going through the roof. Let's say we just finally cracked the code on that thing and we can make batteries that weigh nothing that last forever. And then, you know, adding the 50 squillion gigahertz and all that and all the memory, then you could do powerful multitasking, right?
Well, no, because it's a device that you hold in your hands. You're never going to be able to interface with it as efficient. You're never going to be able to, an iPad. If you take an iPad and you make it the size of an iMac and you give it a mouse and a keyboard, then it ceases to be an iPad. Then it's just become a desktop computer.
But who said it had to have a mouse and a keyboard to be incredibly efficient and be able to do harder things? Oh,
if you want to get a lot of work done, yeah, I'm jumping a little here. In terms of getting a lot of work done, you cannot beat a physical keyboard. And the concept of pointing at a 27-inch screen will give you biceps like Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's not practical or comfortable or nice.
Right.
Looked really cool in Minority Report. Not practical.
But so what you're saying is if we took the iOS operating system and put it on a large computer, then it would be stupid. I'm saying, Right, but I'm saying, what about that small computer becoming more and more cool, having better and better features, better keyboard, tactile something, you know? Why can't it evolve in the other direction?
The more you make it like a desktop, the less it appeals to all the people who really didn't want a desktop. They just wanted something simple to get stuff done. With an iPad, you don't realize that there's an operating system there, to be honest. You're 100% focused on checking your email or surfing the web or doing whatever it is you're doing. That appeals to people. It's not scary. You don't have to know that it has an engine. It's just a little flat piece of glass, and it lets you do things. The moment you make it into a fully-fledged operating system where you can do the kind of powerful things you can do in real OS X, you strip away that simplicity. And you lose that advantage.
So maybe where it ends up going is the 95th percentile sort of thing is that 95% of us only need to do the things that you can do easily on this little handheld device.
Yes, absolutely.
And as with the desktops, you know, Don McAllister is very unlikely to be able to do his job on a laptop without tearing his hair out. I've seen him do it, but it takes a long time. So
if we're going to use the analogy of the truck and the car, you could. It is possible to move an entire 1,000 bricks in a car. It's difficult, but you could do it.
And that's watching Don on his laptop, right?
Exactly.
Right.
Let alone Don on his iPad.
Right.
Trying to edit screencasts online. Not practical. So there's always going to be a need.
But does that mean the PC drops down to this very small percentage of the total
To me, isn't whether or not it drops down to a small percentage. The wiggle room is going to be in whether that's 25 or 5. Just how small is it going to get, to me, is the question. Because I still think that people working in an office environment need proper computers to get their work done. Not all of them, but some of them. So the question is, will it be a quarter of people in offices with traditional computers and 75% with iPad-like simple devices? Or is it going to be 95% with iPad-like simple devices and 5% with computers? That I don't know.
Yeah, that's a really hard one. I've just started flipping through scenarios, as you said, that trying to picture who'd be able to do that. I don't know.
I know for a fact that my entire department at work needs proper computers. But I work in the IT department. That makes me a little teeny bit special in that regard.
Right.
I also know that the people who work in something like the admissions office, I don't think any of them do. They use web applications to interact with the student record system. They use web applications to interact with the other, you know, businessy systems. They send email, they write documents, they give presentations. They may need a keyboard dock.
Right, I was going to say, the keyboard still is pretty important.
The keyboard is pretty important, but don't think they need a full-powered desktop OS. In fact, the fact that we have lots of people using full-powered desktop OSs who don't need it is actually causing us insane amounts of trouble.
Right.
Because all of those security problems, well, not all, but a large amount of the security headaches we have is because people have PCs and they don't need them. They either should be on dumb terminals or on simple devices like the iPod, which are much more secure because they don't have all that power.
So maybe the tablet OS that we have today is going to be the thin client we all wanted to see exist and has still kind of stumbled along. I've done some work with thin clients, and you know, it's an awful lot of management of the operating system, and now we're looking at virtual desktop environments where everybody is logging in from a thin client, but they have their own quote-unquote PC that they get to, but then, you know...
Yeah, but the problem there is you're still trying to make it be like a PC. Don't bother.
Right, right.
The nice thing about the iPad.
Just skip that part, right, and only give them the web interface.
Yeah. Or, I mean, it doesn't have to be a web interface. Imagine a custom-written iPad app to interact with the various systems, you know, the various management systems, MIS, I think is the buzzword for them, in your business.
So at,
like Salesforce, the Salesforce app, that kind of thing.
Right, right, right.
That'd be a really nice experience.
So our friend Mari works on the mechanics and the programming of World of Color, which is this new show at Disneyland that we saw last night. And it's basically, I was trying to think, how would you describe it? Well, it's some fountains, some lights, some lasers, and fire. But it's so much more than that. It is this massive display of these. I mean, these fountains are shooting, I don't know, 50 feet in the air, and there's a full plot going on projected onto the face of the water. You can see Ariel swimming under the sea and all this kind of stuff, and the music is amazing. Whoa. And she said that they one of the guys wrote an iPad app so you could walk around and actually control it from an iPad. I mean, it's this,
that's cool.
There's not a lot of, it's fairly automated, so it's kind of a push a button sort of thing, but he built it so you could control it from that. And there's no reason you couldn't, as you want to be walking around the park, watching what's happening and, you know, checking on things as you're working on it.
Absolutely. And that's something actually that's a part of the iPad people don't think about a lot, but you don't have to get all iPad apps signed by Apple. You can become a part of Apple's sort of corporate environment where you have the power to sign your own apps that can then go to your own iPads and they can't go to any other iPads.
Right.
So you can actually have your own private app store within your corporation.
Right.
And Apple don't get to have a say on that. The apps can only go to your iPads or your iPhones, doesn't really matter which. But, you know, so that kind of thing where you roll your own apps, because a lot of time within IT departments is spent writing custom software because everywhere is different. You cannot go to a shop and buy the perfect software app to do whatever your business does. It doesn't exist.
So maybe where we're going is not necessarily that there's that the desktop is dead in any way, but the total number of computers in people's hands goes up. So those people who didn't ever have laptops, I know a lot of people are saying they're getting them for their parents because they don't want to fool with the whole, you know, understanding how the computer actually works, even if it is a Mac.
Sure.
And so you get computers into those people's hands, or you've got the computer for when you need it, the PC for when you need it, and the tablet form factor of the phone when you don't need the power.
Yeah, the number of total computers is absolutely, positively, definitely going to go massively up. I still think the number of desktops is going to go down. Because there's a lot of people I see who have desktops because that's the only real choice.
Desktops including laptops, right?
Including laptops, right. Traditional PCs.
Yeah.
Who don't actually need them. And for now, even those of us who have iPads still need our desktop PCs or our laptop PCs because an iPad can't stand on its own yet. But of course, that I know will be fixed.
Now, I'm not finding that I'm using my laptop a lot less than I was before I had the iPad. I'm just noticing that I'm using the iPad a lot. It's filling in spaces where I didn't have the laptop with me.
Yeah, but you, I think, will be one of the truck drivers when we're finished this transition.
Yeah, that's true. Until Feeder is written for the iPad and he tells me, don't hold my breath.
But even if your individual apps are, I still think it'll be easier for you, like moving your pile of bricks with a car. You could do it all with your car, but I still think it'll be easier for you to have a truck.
Yeah, probably. But I just, when I sit down in the evenings to relax, it's with my laptop. And I think that keyboard is a big part of it.
It's funny because when I sit down to relax, it's with my iPad.
Oh, interesting. And my iPad is mostly for traveling around when I have to be moving a lot. But the when I'm in the couch and I'm all cozy there, got my little blankie on my toes, I've got my laptop on my lap because it keeps me warm, too. Those cold, frigid summer nights in California, you know?
Intel water bottle.
Yeah, exactly.
No, for me, actually, the iPad is really the relax. I mean, it's so much easier to do simple things. If someone says, oh, who was in that film? Having to find a web browser, get a new tab, blah, blah, blah. No, just give me the iPad and go into IMDb.
Actually, that's a perfect example. When I'm sitting relaxing, I have my iPad right next to me. If someone says who was in that film, I grab the iPad, even though my laptop is open directly in front of me.
It's much less hassle to just grab the iPad.
Now, I am noticing, oddly enough, with the new iPhone, that I'm reaching for it more often than my iPad now. And I don't know if it's just because it's the newest shiny device, or the fact that with that new screen, I can actually see it without wearing my glasses.
It's probably the screen, because that, I mean, the screen on the old iPhone is good, but not good enough, really.
Yeah. I mean, I pretty much can't read the older iPhones without glasses, but this one, I can, you know, given a long enough arm, I can actually do it. So it's terribly sad, but it...
I still remember Mom saying, I had to go get glasses. My arm wasn't long enough.
Another good example of that is I'm reading a book in the Kindle app on the iPad, and I was went down to the pool yesterday, and I didn't really want to bring the iPad down there, and I knew I wouldn't be able to read it in the sunlight anyway. But then I thought, hey, wait a minute. They talked about that whisper sync thing where if you use specifically the Kindle app, all of your devices stay in sync and know where you were in the book. I pulled out my iPhone. There I was in the book. And that bright display, I could read that thing outside.
Cool.
So
that's pretty good.
I haven't checked to see if the iPad knows where I was on the iPhone, but I imagine it'll know where I was. But when I sit down, it's usually to the Mac, to the Mac still.
Excellent. Just to sort of get back to our little why the Mac isn't dead argument. So Steve Jobs' truck and car analogy, I think, is brilliant. That doesn't surprise me because Steve is very much on the ball. If he wasn't, Apple couldn't be Apple. I mean, they can't have delusions about what's the reality of the situation, or they would cease to exist mighty quick. So
well,
it doesn't surprise me that
Steve's driving that reality. I mean,
that too.
They are driving the reality with things like HTML5 and with the tablets and
When Jobs speaks, I think he's describing the actual world, whereas when Ballmer speaks, I think he's describing Cloud Cuckoo Land.
Well, okay, except Steve Jobs is frequently describing the actual future world.
That too.
And in his future world, you're never outside of Wi-Fi range and things like that. 10 years ago, you weren't. In his world, you know?
He is sometimes a little ahead of the curve, all right. And there are arguments about whether or not he should have killed the floppy drive quite so soon.
I think so.
Or the DVD drive in the case of the MacBook Air.
There you go.
But, you know.
Cuckoo.
On the whole, he's connected with reality. He understands things. So I'm not surprised he came up with such an apt analogy, and I think he's spot on. But something we should say just a little more practical, Apple haven't stopped innovating in the desktop market. The 27-inch iMac came out within the last year. That, to me, is a pretty spectacular evolution of the desktop. You have to sit down in front of a 27-inch iMac.
Oh,
but once you do,
shut up.
But no, seriously.
It's 27-inch. Blah, blah, blah.
It is a whole different experience. I went from my 20-inch screen on a giant Mac tower. It was a G5, dual G5 tower, beast of a yoke, to that 27-inch iMac. It's a whole different experience.
Yeah, but you're freezing now. Experience. You're freezing now, though, right? Because you don't have
that
heater in the room?
No, that big screen puts out heat.
Oh, okay, that's
screen,
good.
Yeah, that big screen heats. Have no fear about that. So, you know, that's definitely some innovation they've been doing. But you don't even have to go that far back, and it's not far back. But the Mac Mini was just revamped pretty impressively, a month ago?
Yeah, That was an odd little bird to me. That really smelled like, okay, let's kill off that Apple TV hobby and be done with it. Because I don't know how well the Mac Mini sells to people who aren't using them as media servers.
I know a lot of people who use them as first Macs because they're unintimidating. Yeah. You have a desktop. You have a traditional PC, which means you don't have an all-in-one unit. You have a desktop. You have a tower, monitor, mouse, keyboard. You say to yourself, I think I want to give this Mac thing a go, but I don't want to buy an iMac because I have a good keyboard, mouse, and screen. I'll buy a Mac Mini.
Yeah, but they've priced it so high now. I mean, I think the entry level is $700 when it was $500 or $600 before.
It was, but the thing is, now there are exceptions because there's no such thing as a perfect rule. But in general, people specced up the base model because the base model used to be a Core Solo and it was really quite poor always. The base model was always pathetic. And I know one person on Twitter disagreed with me and said that they had a base model and they were very disappointed it was gone. But of all the people I know in reality, that's not to say, no, not in reality, in real life, in meat space, they all buy one up from the base model, which is what's now the base model. Because what's now the base model is a really good machine with 2 gigs of RAM and decent processor. And, you know, it's a decent machine.
Right.
So everyone I knew was buying that price level and that quality level anyway. So I'm not sure how many people are affected by cutting out the really poor spec bottom of the line.
Yeah, but that's a real common marketing ploy. In fact, that's
it is,
well
yes.
known.
Oh, yeah. PR-wise, it's a big change.
You always do three models, a low, medium, and high, and the low is just there to hold so that people will buy the medium one. Because if you give them medium and high, they don't know which one to pick.
maybe, okay, yeah, maybe it's a bad PR move. But in terms of the actual machine, I've bought lots of Mac Mini. Well, I've bought two myself, and I know lots of people who buy them.
Hmm.
And the two I bought were for €900 and €800.
Hmm. I thought I bought the bottom of the line, but I'm probably lying to myself, so I do that. So yeah, that is interesting though that they are keeping those going. They haven't updated the Mac Pro in 100 years or so, right? Is that one that's
no?
Got people
because the
worried?
Mac Pro I think is a dinosaur.
Oh wait! No! They just added the what am I talking about? They just added the i7 and.
Was a very superficial update.
Really?
The last major update it had was when they went Intel and they completely changed the chassis.
Right. Okay, so does it look different?
Yeah, but not just look, design-wise. Yeah, okay, so they've tinkered about, changed the gearbox and the engine a bit, but they haven't really made a new car, since we're on a car theme.
Right.
Yeah, whereas with the Mac Mini, they really have, because by putting in that HDMI, not DVI, it's the HDMI, but putting in that HDMI port, they have changed that machine quite fundamentally.
See, that didn't seem that big of a deal to me, because I just bought a little adapter from monoprice.com. It was like $20. It took the digital audio out and the USB and turned it into HDMI. It's a little thing.
Yeah, but people don't like to have to do that. So what they're admitting there, that they're recognizing the reality that this machine is really popular as a set-top box. The other thing they did with it, which is even more revolutionary, but they didn't do it this time, they had already done it in the previous revision, is to rip out the optical drive, stick it in a second hard drive, and ship it with OS X server. Because most of the Mac Minis I've ever met in my life, now I'm a sysadmin, so that does skew things a bit, were servers.
Yeah, see, I see that as a market for those. But again, getting back to the basis of our argument of is the PC dead, if everyone's buying Mac Minis for, other than the server people, buying Mac Minis for set-top boxes, then what do we need a big fancy operating system for? All we're using it to browse the web and play video, right?
I think there's three very distinct users of Mac Mini. There's the ones Apple initially intended, the switchers. I know a lot of people whose first Mac is a Mac Mini.
I'll give you that one.
Then there's the people that came along despite what Apple were trying to do, i.e. the Apple TV rejectionists. And then
hands
there's
raised.
The pesky... Yeah, absolutely. And I know a lot of those. And then there's the IT departments who went, it's small, it's cheap, and it's actually quite a good little machine. I'll have me a handful of those.
They're $1,000.
Yeah, that's cheap. That's really, really cheap for a server. And it comes with the full OS X server. You could run an entire small business off a Mac Mini.
Wow.
It's insane. A Mac Mini and an external hard drive for backup.
That's got dual 500...
you could run your entire business.
It's got dual 500 gig, 7200 RPM hard drives.
Yeah.
That's pretty funny.
It's a fantastic little machine. And because it comes with full OS X server, you can literally run your office off just that one little machine.
Hmm.
In fact, if you didn't have too much data, you could actually just use that machine and internally back up to the other physical hard disk. You wouldn't even need an external hard disk for it. That's very powerful.
This is, you know what I like on these big high-powered ones, like I was looking on the towers, it says, buy a Mac, get a free iPod Touch for your student. right next to a $3,300 computer.
G5, yeah. Well, that 17-inch MacBook Pro I'm giving them for college. I think not.
Right.
Let me see, what else did I have in my argumenty things? The other classic one, of course, I remember when the laptop came out. And I remember people swearing blind that the desktop wouldn't outlast the decade. Desktops were dinosaurs. They were going away. We're never going to have desktops anymore. We're all going to have laptops. I see your desktops are dead and raise you a 27-inch iMac.
That's true. You didn't know what they were going to do with the desktops when we said that, right?
Yeah, but I still... there's a difference between you can do things with a machine that doesn't have to move that you just cannot do with a laptop unless you invent anti-gravity. I mean, as a 27-inch MacBook Pro is pushing it. Sorry, 17-inch MacBook Pro is pushing it. Arguably, I'm not sure it still counts as a laptop. It's sort of a portable desktop.
Yeah, see, I don't know. I'm still not sold on the iMac. I mean, I'm sitting here with a 15-inch MacBook Pro with a 24-inch display, so I've got more screen real estate, and yet I can pick it up and walk downstairs with it.
Yeah, but as a workstation, like, I mean, my 27-inch iMac is in work, and as a workstation, it is second to none. And yeah, I could use a laptop, but I would not get as good of an experience with it as you do from that big iMac.
It's Why?
Absolutely perfect as a workstation.
Why? Why is it better?
It's because of all that screen real estate.
Yeah, but I've got more screen real estate with my setup.
Yeah, but, well, for a start, it's cheaper for me just to get the 27-inch iMac than to buy a big screen and to buy a notebook. Because it's redundant to buy a notebook if you don't need a notebook. Because it actually costs more money to make it into that neat little package.
Yes, yes.
And it does the bolt to the back of a giant screen.
So second to none per dollar, maybe I'll give you. But I won't give you second to none.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the right tool for the right job.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And, you know, that experience, I wouldn't do without. I would be very cranky if I was forced down the traditional laptop experience, i.e. not with a giant screen too, but just a laptop. That would not make my work life better. Would not make me more productive and would certainly not make me happier.
There you go. Well, hey, I think we can call this one. You heard it here. The Mac is not dead.
I'm telling you, macOS 10.7 is going to come out and it's going to knock our socks off. I don't know how, but it will.
That's not our job to know. Remember what Don told us. We're just supposed to wait for Steve to tell us what we need. On that note, I think we better wind our show up here for this week, Bart.
Okay, I don't get to make my toothbrush analogy.
Okay, go ahead.
Just because you can do almost anything in an iPod doesn't mean you want to. You could paint your entire house with a toothbrush. But you wouldn't want to, not even with an electric one.
Okay, on that note, can we wind it up?
Absolutely. Business as usual next week?
I think we're on schedule.
I think so too. So until then, happy computing.
Well, I guess I should have added up all the times of those great reviews because I didn't notice that they added up to one of the longest shows ever. Heck, I should have saved a couple so I could lollygag for no reason at all next week. Well, I hope you had unusually bad traffic this week and were excited by how long the show was. Hey, one more thing I need to tell you about, I almost forgot, is Steve actually has a review on the Mac ReviewCast on Tim Verporten's show. So you should go check that out at macreviewcast.com. I'm in it too, but it's mostly Steve, and I think you'll get a big kick out of it. Well, hey, next time you're not busy on a Sunday night around 4:30 p.m., that's Sunday night my time because the world does revolve around me, come on over to the live show at podfeet.com/live. This week, Country Lad and Adam joined us for the first time, and they appeared to have a great time with all the other Nocilla castaways. They're really a fun crowd. You can also follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.